Okay, so we're taking up a dialogue between Moshe and Paro. There are some that are very interesting in the course of the 10 plagues. This one is in Bo, it's Perek Yud, which is 10. This is, to put it in context, this is after the Makkah of Barad. The last three, Barad, Arba, and Choshech, are much more devastating. They increase in force. The aspect of inflicting fear and terror, visiting fear and terror upon the Egyptians, in order to get them to recognize God. So this is after the Barad. Then you can see that in as they get more painful, Paro is really wavering. He's wavering, and on a number of occasions, he sort of agrees to let them go, and at the last moment, he withdraws. So there's always a condition, something comes up, and because of that, he refuses to let them go. Now here, it begins on actually the beginning of, it's Bo. Bo El Paro. God says to go to Paro, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants in order to establish my signs amongst them. We're not taking up for now the meaning of the hardening of the heart. Whether there's two interpretations, we've done this a number of times. Does this mean that God intervened to prevent them from doing tshuva, which is the view of the Rambam? Although when the Rambam discusses it, he says it with regard to Paro himself. The Rambam does not say that this occurred to the servants. He says Paro himself. The pasuk over here indicates not just him, but the heart of the servants. So that's interesting. However, the Sforno learns the exact opposite. The Ramban brings both of these interpretations down. And he says that, to the contrary, apparently according to the Sforno, God never, ever prevents a human being, takes away the power of Bechira, takes away the power of free will. And the ways of tshuva are always open. That does not mean to say that a person cannot lose his power of free will. That's not what this Forno is saying. That's something that a person should be very concerned about. That is, the sin itself. A person can reach a certain level of indulgence where, practically speaking, he may not be able to exercise Bechira in an area. That, I think, is something we should pause on or consider. Of course, we can see that with regard to addiction. I'm not talking about substance addiction. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a sinful behavior that a person should realize that the sin has consequences and that the balance of forces in his psyche change. And the willpower of the individual becomes weaker and weaker. Sin has many effects upon a person. And in terms of his commitment to truth, in terms of his willingness to change, in terms of the power of his will versus the power of his instincts, the instinctual element becomes more and more powerful. So that it's possible that with time, let's put it this way, there's no question that it can become much more difficult. A person can act in a manner where he can develop certain habits that are very powerful, and they can reach a point where, for all intents and purposes, he can't change. Now, at that, God only knows whether he can. I mean, it could reach a point where he could change only under certain tremendous pressures, but those pressures aren't going to be there. So that the Sforno is not saying that a person can never lose his power of Bechira. I would say that that is the case, that people can lose their power of Bechira. For all intents and purposes. They just can't. They can't find it in themselves to muster the strength because many factors, habit, their weakness, their convictions, and the strength of the instinctual. So this has changed the balance of psychic forces, and they are no longer in a state of Bechira with regard to certain kinds of things. Not to mention that there's other factors too. Don't forget the usually, I mean, we're talking about serious wickedness. It becomes a movement. It becomes entrenched. It becomes very difficult for many, many reasons to make a change. So that's not what he's talking about. What the Sforno is saying is that God did not prevent him from doing tshuva. To the contrary, it was the will, God wanted him to do tshuva. And it is only because of that that he hardened his spirit. Because, ironically, it turns out that the hardening of the heart, according to the Sforno, is for the exact opposite reason. That, according to the Rambam, it's to prevent him from doing tshuva. To teach the world that when a person reaches a certain degree of wickedness, he loses the power of Bechira. However, for the Sforno, it's just the opposite. That is, that the types of punishments that God was going to bring down upon them would have been such that the ordinary individual would have been crushed. He wouldn't have been able to withstand. And he would have given in, but not because he recognized the Creator. That would not be the sanctification of God. The person just gives in, yields, because of superior force, but not because he recognizes the truth. So there's no sanctification of God. So therefore, he was given a certain amount of strength that he wouldn't be crushed. He wouldn't be crushed. And of course it would affect him. There's an element of balance in the whole issue of free will. There has to be a certain balance. That is, it's okay to apply pressure. But the pressure itself is there to trigger the mind. To trigger the mind. And the mind should engage in a battle with the emotions. And ultimately, the decision should be made by the mind, not by the... Now, at what degree, at what point is the pressure too overwhelming that the person can't withstand and he gives in? Only God can determine that. That's a quantitative factor. So it means over here that God hardened him if the person's too soft and he can't take it, so then of course he's going to give in. That's not a choice. On the other hand, if he's too hard, then it doesn't affect him, so then he's not going to do tshuva either. So it's got to be the element of pain that he suffers has to be at a certain degree, which only God can determine. According to the Rambam, you have to say that Paro might have done tshuva. We don't know whether he would or wouldn't have. Had God not intervened and hardened his heart, then Paro might have done tshuva. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't have. But as a result of the hardening of the heart, he no longer had that option. Now, another example would be the people of Nineveh. The people of Nineveh were very, very wicked. So this factor as to when God does this and when God does not, we really don't know. The case of Nineveh is the general rule. Kilo achbots, God says, I don't desire the death of the wicked, but rather that he changes his ways and does tshuva and lives. So the people of Nineveh were extremely wicked to the point that Jonah did not want to be involved in saving them. He thought they should be destroyed. But we see that they had free will because they would not have done tshuva. But when they were faced with the reality that the prophet came to warn them that in 3 days Nineveh is going to be destroyed, so then they were broken and they did tshuva. So that's a case, that's an example of what could happen. Didn't have to happen, it's free will. It's great Rishayim, where God does not intervene. Had God intervened, as God intervened over here, then they would have been doomed, and they would not have done tshuva, and that's it. The point is, it's good to remember that as a rule, it does not happen. The rule is that people do not do tshuva. Well, because most people are creatures of habit. Habit is a powerful thing. The Rambam talks about that, how significant habit is. And in fact, when the Rambam talks about karbanos, that's why the Torah didn't even uproot the system of karbanos, but it embraced it, it incorporated it, and connected the true ideas to karban, because the Torah couldn't have made such a demand upon people. Couldn't. Because people are creatures of habit. Because people are creatures of habit, a person must strive to develop good habits, because what's going to save you in the long run is your habits. And you are going to act in accordance with your habits 99% of the time. So if you want to live a good life, then you really need to develop good habits. As opposed to when I'll decide then. You know, when a major challenge arises, or the challenges of life, and so on and so forth, of course a person can act out of character. It's possible that due to the situation, a person will act out of character. But it's very unlikely. Most people act in character. And that's what the world is about. The world is about people acting in accordance with their nature. If you don't change your nature, then you're not going to, most of the time, you're not going to do the correct thing. Therefore, due to the fact that habit is so determinative and so significant, the general rule is that people that do not develop good character traits, good habits, are not going to do tshuva. They're not going to do tshuva because they're going to act according to their nature. And since they've allowed themselves to develop a wicked nature or an evil nature, or one that's habituated to doing, to just gratifying the instincts, that's pretty much the way it's going to be. If a person wants to do the good, then he's got to incorporate that into his nature, not just affirm it. To merely affirm the good without incorporating it into your nature is insufficient. Because of this, it's as you get older, generally speaking, it's harder. It's more difficult. That's because many other factors as well. That element within you that has the capacity to effectuate change within the self becomes weaker. You don't have the same kind of strength. You don't have the same kind of energy. You don't have the same kind of determination. There's a certain resignation. And also the habits have been there for so long. This is you. This is the way you see yourself. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible. Great people have made changes even when they were older. You have Rabbi Akiva who was ignorant until he was 40. It doesn't mean to say that it's impossible. It does, however, mean that there's a reality. And like the Rambam says, you could do tshuva on your deathbed, but how often is that going to happen? By that time, a person is used to looking at life in a certain way. It's characteristic. This is a very important point. I make this point all the time. How many people do you know that are involved in growth? In growth at any point in their life, but when you're young, you have a certain amount because you have to. You're evolving. You haven't reached any point at which you can, so to speak, stabilize. Once people become adults and there's a certain stability, let's assume that they've set up their life, their profession, let's assume that they get married, they have children, how do you still see progress? Do you still see change? No, it's minimal. They are pretty much the same. Where do you see a person that's constantly changing and he's not the same though he was 10 years ago? He's still learning new things. He's still working on his personality. He's still developing. Very, very rare. Most people evolve. That's it. This is me. And the way they are, their reactions to life and situation, it's pretty much the same. The way when they're 60, that's the way it was when they're 40, and that's the way it is when they're 70, and that's the way it was when they were 30. It's the same person. Very rare that you could say, you know, this is not the same person. This person, and that's the way I thought about it then, but I've changed because I reviewed that, I revisited that area, and I've made some changes. You don't hear that kind of talk. No, that's the way I feel about life. That's most people will very proud of the fact that's me, that's my thing, I believe in this and that, but why do you believe in that? Because you just accepted it, because it was pleasing for you to accept it, and that's your point of view, and you're a Democrat, and that's why you vote Democrat. And that's it. Where do you find any growth? You don't find growth. Ordinarily, tshuva is very, very difficult, especially for stubborn people and strong-willed people and so on and so forth. Once a certain way of thinking and acting is entrenched, that's the way it stays. The only hope, however, is if there's some kind of a crisis, something to shake them up. When people undergo a crisis, then they have an opportunity. As long as they can get by with their pattern, whatever it is, they're getting by, or they're successful, and so on and so forth, so they're definitely not going to rethink their life. It needs a crisis. So that's what happened to Nineveh. The people in Nineveh were not disposed to change, because whatever the system was, the wickedness of the system, they're not going to recognize. The only ones that recognize the wickedness are the victims, but the oppressors themselves are not going to change. But the crisis, the message from the Navi, the prophet, that in 3 days Nineveh will be destroyed, that's a crisis. That causes people to introspect. Even so, it's not a guarantee. Even so, it's not. It's not a simple story that once they heard the message, they're going to do tshuva. But they did. And the same is true over here. Paro was now faced with the consequences of his policies. In and of itself, he was satisfied. It worked out. Whatever caused them to look at the Jews this way, to enslave the Jews, etc. They got it through. They worked it out. It was in place. It was a very good program for them because they were exploiting the Jews. Now there was consequences. There was major consequences, and there was going to be a catastrophe. And this would have an effect upon, it did have an effect upon Paro, and it did have an effect upon his servants. So the question is, well, why didn't it get them to let the Jews go? They acted so irrationally. At the end of the day, the Jews left. The Jews left. They lost the Jews, and the country was devastated, and their idols were destroyed. They lost. Not only that, but even afterwards, they didn't have enough. Take a look at the devastation of the Makas Pachoros, the firstborn. That very night, Paro himself gets up. Whether he goes to, according to Rashi, he went to Moshe personally, whether it means he sent his messengers, it doesn't matter. They wanted them to go immediately. Moshe said, we're going to go in the morning, we're not going to sneak out. But they wanted them to leave immediately. So you'd think they had enough. It says that there was a scream in Egypt like there had never been before, or never ever would be again. Such a devastation. But how long did it take until they're back? They chase after them at the Kriyas Yamsuf. Thus, one can see the Rambam's point. It's hard for Rabbi to... Was this free will? According to... We would think that a certain amount of rationality would prevail at this point in time. But absolutely no rationality prevailed. A complete absence of rationality. He should have backed off. That's it. He lost this battle, couldn't do it, could not accept defeat. Was that because of his wickedness? According to the Sfarno, that was his wickedness. According to the Rambam, that was because he did not have the power to do tshuva. So he had to die in his wickedness. It was a foregone conclusion. The lesson of this, of course, is that a person should do tshuva. Not that anyone is making a comparison to people like this, but also to... If something is good, if a person has a certain image of himself as being a good person and this and that, a compassionate person, a sweet person, everybody has a very favorable self-image. The thing to do is not just to have that attitude towards yourself, but to actually see that you're incorporating those, to make that part of your nature, to develop good habits. That's more important than to embrace a certain image of yourself. That's very nice, that's a starting point, but if you don't make it concrete by developing good habits, so that these become your habits. If you do the good deeds continuously, then they'll become part of your nature. That's the Rambam's approach. All right, now we're going to get into the particular dialogue which precedes the plague of the Arba. This is after the Barad, this is the locust. This is very severe because it's going to consume all of the vegetation of Egypt, whatever was left over from the Barad. So you're really hitting home very, very hard. A famine, so to speak. It's like the famine, the severity. So it says that Moshe and Aaron came to Paro and said to him, Kamar Hashem, Elokei Ivrim, thus says Hashem, the God of the Jews, Ad Mosei Me'anto Le'onos Mipanai. For how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Lihikana, Rashi says, I'm sorry, Rav Sadi Gaon, Lihikana, to humble yourself. Rashi says the same thing. Me'anto lios ani v'shafel mipanai. For how long will you hold back from being lowly? Humble. Humbleness is exceedingly important. Now you see why Paro couldn't do tshuva. Arrogance. That's another factor. The more a person acts in a wicked manner, the more arrogant he becomes, and he loses completely the capacity for humility. Shalach ami v'yavduni, send forth my nation that they may worship me. Ki im mo'ein ato l'shalech adami, for if you refuse to send forth my nation, hinini mevi machar, now he's telling him specifically, you have till tomorrow. That's very, very important, because immediacy, when you make a threat, should you mention when, or should you just leave it vague? Warning. When you give a warning to someone, people do it, parents do it all the time. Is it better to leave it vague, or is it better to mention a specific? Vague very often can be, I'm not saying that there's never a time, sometimes it is a little bit better to leave things vague. You always have to use seichel in every case. It's hard to like formulate absolute rules. But in general, it should be real. So you should mention when, because then it has reality. To the extent that you keep it vague, the other person hears it, is not convinced that you mean it. Therefore, before you do issue a warning, then you'd better be prepared to carry it out. Thus, a lot of times we say things that are just too crazy. You issue these warnings and they're overkill. And then you realize it and you don't want to carry it out. Thus, it's best to be prepared to carry out what you're saying. And therefore, you should say it clearly, and then the person knows that whenever you don't issue empty warnings. So here, you have all the elements. Hinani mevi machar, I'm going to bring tomorrow, which means you have time to think about it. Arbe bigvulecha. Also, if it was going to be in 5 minutes, then, you see again, room is being given to Paro and his servants to make a decision. They're not being, it's not that he's putting a gun to his head. He's issuing a threat and a warning. He's foretelling what will happen. But if it was going to be in 5 minutes, then it would be like a gun to his head. So he has time to think about it. That's very important, that you should think it over and make it a free will decision. Well, I mean, according to the Rambam, you don't have free will, but according to the Sforno, you do have free will. In either case. V'chisa azein haaretz. And they will cover the ground, the view of the ground. V'lo yuchal liros es haaretz. You will not be able to see the land. Rashi says, et mare haaretz, the appearance of the land. That's one thing. V'lo yuchal haroeh. And anyone who would be looking at it will not be able to see the ground. It just seems to be a little bit redundant. V'yachal es yeser apleta, hanish eres lachem in abarad. Well, basically, the first point is communicating the sheer extent of it, the full extent of it. Because the second one, I understand that it's going to consume whatever was left over. That's hitting them in terms of their security. They were just devastated by the barad. It's like you have these tremendous storms and it destroys the crops and so on. So whatever is left over is precious. At least we have something we can survive on. But now, part two. It's sort of a follow-up. It's a follow-up to the barad. And whatever was left over, it's going to consume. You also see a certain pattern. It's not just random. Sometimes you could have two random events happening. Both are bad, but they're not connected to each other. Here you see, it's not random. It's a follow-up. So all of the anxieties that were stirred up by the previous one, maybe you got over them, it's going to reawaken them. So part one is the sheer extent of it. That's why it's mentioning, perhaps. A certain amount you can deal with. It's kind of like an infestation. From time to time, you may have mice, you may have bugs, you may have this, you may have that. But the mind always looks to the quantitative. How much? Maybe it's normal. Maybe it's a little bit bad, but it's not the worst thing in the world. But then you just can't ignore it. It's like all over the place. I can't believe it. Wherever we turn, we've got ants. It could be that that's the point to drive home the sheer extent of it, that it'll cover the ground. That's one thing. But that doesn't mean every square inch. Then the second point is that one would not be able even to see the land. So that's a blemish, that it would appear like the whole land is covered in locust. And then it'll consume whatever is left off, whatever has been left over from the barad, from the hail. And they will eat every tree that grows from the that grows in the field. And then they will fill the houses. It's just interesting to note, why would they go into the houses? I'm not sure. I would imagine that they'll go after whatever food is in the house. That was the distinctive feature of the Sephardim, that the Sephardim also went in the house. That's what Paro, even though Paro had the magicians duplicated, but he gave in. He gave in, he agreed at that point anyways, to let them go. Then he changed his mind, but it brought him down because it was all over the place. He couldn't escape. He found no escape. So that's another... There are certain common themes in the Makos. The fact that it attacks the food supply. And the first one was the water. This is the food. The barad. Barad has many elements to it. The fear factor, the devastation. It's a destructive thing. Whoever didn't bring his slaves and animals from the field, they were killed. But more beyond that, it destroyed the trees and the crops. The destruction of the food supply. So it will fill up your houses, and the houses of your slaves, and the houses of all Egypt. But tangentially, there's a separate issue, which we're not taking it up now. Separate issue, it's a matter of contention. Did all of the Makos, were the Jews exempted? They were only afflicted the Egyptians, only the Egyptians, but the Jews didn't suffer from any. Or does point out in certain cases that, for example, by Choshech, that in all the Jewish houses there was light. And by the Barad, for example, that he sent to Goshen, and by Goshen it didn't. The Evan Ezra contends that all of the Makos afflicted everybody, except where the Torah pointed out. However, there's disagreement on this point. The Rambam, for example, disagrees. And the Ramban, I believe, disagrees as well. There are others that disagree and maintain that the Makos only afflicted the Egyptians, not the Jews. That's a separate point. So, getting back to the pasuk, that your entire house and the house of your slaves will be filled, such that was never seen, your fathers and your father's fathers, from history, from the time that they were on the land, from the time that anybody, means the entire history of Egypt. Such a thing has never been seen, until this day. That's a very important point, because the Rambam talks about this. What distinguishes something as being miraculous, as being beyond the Teva? This type of phenomenon in and of itself was not miraculous. That is to say, the nature, the quality, that there were, from time to time there's an attack of locusts. If there's an attack of locusts in and of itself, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a punishment from God. It could happen, part of nature. How do you know that thus that the that this is a miracle? So here you see something can be natural, but the quantitative factor can differentiate it. It's never happened like this. That is, that it covers the entire scope of the ground, and that nobody can even see the ground, and then it fills up all of the houses and so on, and the fact that it's never ever happened like this before. There's never been a case like this before. Which means that whatever is within the framework of nature, so it has a certain limit to it as well. But it's unlike. It's different. So this should cause you to ponder. This is not produced by nature. It's got to be produced by something beyond nature. Now, it's expressing itself within nature. What is happening is a natural phenomenon, but it's not conforming to the natural laws. According to the natural laws, you wouldn't have such a thing. So the last thing is to look back in history. Did it ever happen before? So Moshe is instructing them. They had history. They had their records. Check. And you will see that from the time that Egypt was established as a nation, a thing like this was never recorded. Oh, it's interesting. It says Vayifan Vayetim in Paro, and he turned and he left from before Paro. Why must the Torah tell you this? One could have, you could have left this out, because obviously you need to know that the deliberations, then they deliberate, not in the presence of Moshe. Okay, but that point could have been made, because the next pasuk says that the Avdei Paro said to him, the servants of Paro said to him, for how long shall this be a stumbling block? Send forth the men and let them serve the Lord their God. Do you not know that Egypt is already lost? There's different ways that this could be read. Rashi says, do you still not know that Egypt is lost? That seems to be that they're standing up to Paro. You get a certain, there is a certain element, I don't know if you want to call it disrespectful. The Ramban takes up this question. The Ramban says, because they were very much afraid by the barad, by the hail, so Moshe thought that they would be extremely frightened now that they would die from the famine. What remained of the crops were to be destroyed. Therefore, he left without his permission before they would answer yes or no, in order to that they should think it over. And indeed, his thought was correct because you see, subsequently, that they, at least for the time being, that they brought him back and agreed to his demand. I think that's his first shot that he quotes. Means that he didn't want them to answer right away. He wanted to give them, perhaps, you see, there's a certain, you could see an interesting factor over here. If Moshe is present, they have a certain pride. So sometimes a person wants to save face. Yeah, that's a very, very, very important thing. Give a person room. Let a person have, whenever you're involved in some kind of a confrontation, you're trying to work things out, but you don't want to just give in, and so on and so forth. You're demanding something from the other person. If you do it in a way that the other person is going to be humiliated, it's going to be very, very hard. Very often the other person would agree, but you're not giving him any face saving. That's a big thing in diplomacy. That the diplomats are very conscious of this. That they work things out in a way that the other person gives in, but they present it as though he didn't give in, or it's called a face-saving gesture. Face is very important in an imperfect world, because people can't, their ego, they can't acknowledge that they've been defeated, so it's a smart thing to be cognizant of. It's definitely a smart thing to be cognizant of. And it works on every level, no matter who you're dealing with, including your spouses and everything. Don't humiliate the person. So perhaps that's the point, that it's telling you that Moshe didn't want them to have that problem. Because maybe if he's there, it looks like they're going to give in to him. They didn't think it over, to give them an opportunity to think it over and decide what you want to do. The heat of the moment. That's an important point also, because when you've just hit somebody, so, you know, you're going to get a reaction. A certain amount is going to be the immediate reaction. The Ramban doesn't really stick with this pshat, though. It says, nevertheless, that's what they did, for they said to Paro, Haterem Teda. So the servants had to intervene. Ki Avda Mitzrayim. I could see that point. That is to say that Moshe was coming from a position of strength and threatening them. He was threatening them and warning them. And that itself creates a certain resistance. You see, if you do that, if you sometimes you take a position, the other person, because of his pride, will feel that he has to oppose you. So, and you're lording it over him. You're sort of like, you know, you're expecting him to cave in. So because you're expecting him to cave in, he's not going to cave in. So it's better to just leave. So you remove that factor. Then he quotes another view. He says, "Vanachom bi'enai." What makes sense to me? Sometimes the Ramban will do that. He'll quote different opinions, and then he'll give what he thinks is correct. Kichen hoya osa b'choleis bo al paro. That this is what he did every time. That is what the Torah is describing here. That he would come, he would make his case and leave. El hechola, when he came to the palace, masra bo, he would warn him. V'yotze milfanov, and then leave. But the pasuk had to mention it here, Bavur Vayushav es Moshe, because it says that they brought him back. Question needs to be raised, though. It's just one word, but why does it say Vayifen Vayesa? He turned and left. I mean, it should have simply said that he left. What's the idea of the turning? I think that Vayifen is communicating the idea. Now, even though he was commanded to show respect to Paro, that doesn't mean, that means he wasn't disrespectful. But I don't, I think, this, see, there's two ways. When you go, when you have a meeting, everything is done officially. When you have a meeting with the rulers or the king, there's an official etiquette about how you come in. And even if you, it was a bad meeting, didn't go well, but then there's an official way in which you take leave. Everything is scripted. You can't just, you don't just walk out. Now, you don't just walk out of the Oval Office or something like that. When the meeting is over, it's over, and you're escorted out. Let's put it that way. I would say that he was not being, that's not the way Moshe did it. That, because that would be in contradiction to the very severity of the message. He's coming from Hashem. And he didn't have to. I think the command was that he wasn't disrespectful to him, but he didn't observe all the diplomatic niceties either, because he had a special message from Hashem. And when you're representing Hashem, so then as soon as it was over, he left. He turned and he left. Means he turned and he left meant he didn't go through the normal procedures, like an ordinary visitor. An ordinary visitor couldn't do that. Whatever the procedure was, he had to observe. Here, it would have diminished from his role as being the spokesman of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that, when it came to doing those kinds of things, he didn't do that. I'm not sure whether this was the case in all of the meetings, whether sometimes he did act more respectfully. I'm not sure. That's what I think it means over here. It could be that this is the way it was in all the cases, and then it just says Vayetze, that he left, but we know from here that Vayifen, I'm not sure yet. But I think that's what Vayifen signifies. Vayifen signifies the fact that he didn't wait for the meeting to be ended and to be escorted out in accordance with the laws of the diplomacy. It does say after the first maka of the dam, Vayifen Paro, Vayoshev El Beso, he returned to his house. And that's very significant, because the question that I asked over there is, so what do I know? Of course he went to his house. What do I care where where would he go? No, because that was part of his whole denial. He was able to escape from the reality by returning to his house. So, I mean, he turned away from the reality. It had an effect upon him. And he was in a state of conflict. So what did he do? He sought to escape by going to his house. That's a different reality. There, everything catered to his own fantasies. It's interesting, that's why the very next one that's fired them, he says, they'll fill up your house and on your bed and in the oven, means you won't have any place to escape. Okay. Vayifen is to turn away from something. And by Paro it meant he turned away from the reality. That is, he sought to escape from the reality. Another point is that most people, when they go to visit a king or whatever, so obviously they're at the mercy of the king. And also, they derive a certain satisfaction out of being negotiating with the king and so on. It plays to their ego. Moshe didn't, he had no interest whatsoever. He was just there. He was just there for the sake of the message from Hashem, and that's it. Of course, it's true that as long as Moshe is there, it makes it harder for the servants. Because in front of the king, it appears that they're taking his side. Okay. Once Moshe was gone, the servants were free to speak their own minds, which they couldn't do in front of Moshe. You never do that. Okay. So now the servants speak up. The ministers, I suppose, his advisors. And Admasai, for how long should this be for a stumbling block? Send forth the men. And then, don't you know that Egypt will be lost? That's a very powerful message. We're looking at absolute annihilation over here. That is, how are we going to survive? The Arba. So then, Moshe and Aaron were brought back. In the case of this is the first time that the prior warning of an impending Maka causes Paro to make agreements. At least to give the impression that he's making agreements. This seems to be a bit of an improvement in that here, they are willing, for the time being, to give in before. The warning itself was sufficient. This is the first time where the warning itself is sufficient. That's why you can see the connection with the Barad. Because it is a continuation of the Makkah of the Barad, to wipe out whatever remains. And the realization that they're facing catastrophe. So they brought back Moshe and Aaron to Paro. And he said to them, he, of course, is Paro. L'chu ivdu et Hashem Elokeichem, go and serve the Lord your God. Which he should have stopped at that point. Mi v'mi aholchem. Who is going? That seems like a legitimate question. He's now going to decide who has permission to go. Vayomer Moshe, and Moshe said, Bin Arenu ubizkeneinu nelech. With our children and with our elders, we will go. Bivaneinu ubivnosenu. With our sons and daughters. Bitoneinu ubivkarenu. With all of our sheep and our cattle, Nelech, Kichagar Hashem Lanu. Because it's a holiday of Hashem for us. And this, at first glance, Paro's reaction that Paro was opposed to this, obviously. At first glance, it seems to be, his position doesn't seem to be crazy. That is, this is a religious phenomenon. So, who should go? Everybody has to go. Every single person, and the children, and the elderly. It sounds a little bit strange. Ramban, Amiva Miyahochim, Vayapara Rota Sheyelchu Roshehem, Siknehem, Vishodrehem, Anashim Ashenikvu Bishemos. Para wanted that the significant ones, the leaders, the elders, the distinguished ones, should go. Moshe answered that also the sons and daughters will go, because there's a festival of Hashem for us. U'mitzvah al kulanu lochog lefanav. And it's a mitzvah for all of us to celebrate before him. Az chara leparo al abadim ve'alabanos. Then Paro got angry about the sons and daughters. V'yamar shelo yishalach ataf b'shum panim. He said he would not send the children in any case, under any circumstances. Ki heim lo yizbechu, because they don't sacrifice. But he would send all of the male, the grown-up children, or the grown-up males, rather. And that the women and the children should remain behind. This was the machlokas. This was the argument between Paro and Moshe. So, Bayomer, he said to them, Yehi chein Hashem imachem. He's basically saying, so Hashem should be with you when I send you and your children see that there is evil in front of you. Well, the Sforno says, it's a very difficult, it's a very cumbersome phrase. The Sforno says that see that you're going about your business to El Hara Lachem, to something which will be harmful. Evil will find you. Now, plain meaning, perhaps, is that it's very dangerous to go. Not so. L'chuna ha'gvarim. Let the men go and serve God, for that's what you want. That's Paro's response, in this case, seems to be sensible. The Rashbam says, L'avodas Hashem atem avakshim p'nai. You want to serve God. V'im kein tafanashim lama. So what do you need the women and the children? He says, Vayigarsho sameis p'nei Paro. And he just drove them out from before Paro. Now there are those who say that Re'u ki ra'a, that he meant is that you have an evil intention. That this is just a guise that you intend to escape. And that's why. It doesn't make sense to bring along everybody. Why don't you just bring along the men and let the women stay behind with the children? That's what the Chizkuni says. That you're really planning to escape. To me that makes sense. That Moshe's proposal was that they all should go. And Paro had asked them who's going. And Moshe said everything. We're taking everything with us. men, women, children, elderly, and the animals as well. So what Paro's reaction seems to make to be sensible. What's this? That's got to be some kind of a trick. You plan to escape, because why would you need to bring everything along? I think what Moshe is saying when he gives his explanation, Paro's point was that you're going out to serve God, to sacrifice. So go out and do it. See, Paro had the idea of a cult, a religion, and so you have to do certain things. That he understood. But it would be inconceivable for that kind of a, if it was Paro, for example, that they would have to bring out everybody, whoever engages it brings the sacrifices. I think what Moshe was saying was that that's not the essence of the thing. In other words, we're going to bring this, doesn't mean the children are going to bring the sacrifices. But the sacrifices is part of a whole experience. And this type of an experience, everybody will be engaged in it. The whole nation. It's a national phenomenon. So then that's a different thing. That was what his answer was. It's true, the children don't bring sacrifices, but that's not the... sacrifices is part of it. But the essence is not the sacrifice. For the others, the essence is the sacrifice. Because it's a cult. And you just engage in whatever the religious activity is, whatever, everybody has their own religious activities, and then you do them, and that's the end of that. But Moshe was saying, that's not what we're doing over here. The essence is not the sacrifices. The essence is the chag. We're having a chag. And that affects the entire nation. It says that he drove them away. What happened to his fear, though? What happened to the argument of the, sir, you know, what's going on here? But they just seem to convince them that we should agree. Or else Egypt is destroyed. What happened to that? I think that Paro felt that he fulfilled the condition in a way that made sense. You're requesting 3 days. Your God is requesting to let you go, to worship him in the wilderness. That's what I'm giving into that. But the other part of it is wrong. That's what he osa atem avakshim. In other words, he's giving into what you really want. This is what you really want. Rashi says on Yeraf, lo chein, not so, kasher amartem, as you said, laholach atafi machem. Everything revolved around the children. But, lechuna hagvarim, v'yivdu as Hashem, ki osa atem avakshim, ki osa bikashnem adheno, because that's what you've asked until now. That's what you've been asking for. And I'm willing to give it. Nizbuchal elokeinu. That is, until now you've been asking for one thing, to sacrifice unto Hashem, unto your God, and now I'm willing to give it in. But this request for the children doesn't make sense. It's not the derech of the children to sacrifice. A Paro, at first glance, doesn't seem to be that terrible over here. He seems to be willing to give in. He is giving in, but not on Moshe's terms. And he's making the point that your terms are not reasonable. Paro, it seems, was affected by the argument. He's not just being arbitrary and saying, oh, who is God, like he said at first. Not the case at all. He's acknowledging God. In fact, perhaps that's Yehi Chein Hashem Imachem. I'm acknowledging God. Okay, let God be with you. I'm accepting that point. I've seen the light. Let God be with you. But if I were to send you out with your children, well, either that's a God, you know, either the evil is because you're planning a trick, or it's not a good thing. It's not clear what the evil is. Some say that you're just going to encounter evil because you're going to be engaging in a trick, and then you're going to have to face the consequences. Yeah, the Evan Ezra says that Paro thought that they want to escape. And then this is interesting to note this Evan Ezra for a different context. That this is the place where the Evan Ezra says, he's taking up the question, did they lie? That's not a question for today. But did Moshe practice deceit? Because they all along said that they're just going a distance of 3 days, and then they're going to come back. That's the implications anyways. And that basically they were not asking to be freed from the enslavement. They were just asking for an opportunity to go and serve God. which makes it very, very difficult. You see the stubbornness of Paros. Let them go. But he wouldn't do that. But then, in point of fact, they had no intention of coming back. So, it's another. Was that deception? That they lied and said that they're just going to go for 3 days? Now, the Ibn Ezra addresses that. In the middle of Yud, he says, V'dak ki Moshe Adoneinu lo amar l'paro, that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say to Paro, sheyashuvu, that he would return, ad sheyichazev, so that he would be a liar. Rak amar sheyarchiku derash lo shishavim. All he said was that they're going to travel a distance of 3 days. V'das ha-mitzriyim ha-yiso sheyashuvu. The Egyptians thought they were going to return. Al-kein ha-shilom. And that's why they lent them. They lent them things. Because they thought that they were going to come back. Ubavur davar achar. She'ilu nasan lehem paro rishus lo leches v'lo yeshuvu. He's going further with this. He's saying if Paro had given them permission to go and would never return, lo hayarodef achareim. And he wouldn't have chased after them. Because it seems very, very strange. Why would Paro, 1 minute he's letting them go because of the Makas Pachoros, and then he's chasing after them. So what the Ibn Ezra is saying is that there was a deception going on over here. There was a big deception. That the Egyptians thought that all they wanted was to go for 3 days. And then they would come back. And in spite of that, it was exceedingly difficult. They wouldn't give him. But finally they were going to give it. And by Makas Pachoros, that's all Paro thought he was letting them do. Because if he gave them permission to leave, well, I mean, you can learn it that way. Mazos, what did we do? You can learn it that they did give them permission to leave, then they had a change of heart. But the way the Ibn Ezra is learning is that they were surprised. They saw they weren't coming back. He said, and Hashem commanded them to do this, so that he would chase after them and be drowned. And he said, that's v'yeshuvu v'yachnu l'fnei p'yachiros. V'ein laharer achar maaseh Hashem. And one can't question, can't wonder about the actions of God. Shakol osa b'chachma. Because everything was done with chachma. Afal pi shehi ne'lemes me'enei hacham. Even though it's hidden from the eyes of the chacham. What happened was, of course, that Moshe stretched out his hand. Hashem said to Moshe to stretch forth his hand and over the land of Egypt. And the makkah of the arba, of the locust, ensued. And everything happened just like he said. Covered the entire land. It ate all the vegetation. Whatever was left from the barad. It doesn't mention anything about going in the houses. Then it says that the locust went forth over the land and spread out throughout the entire boundary. Heavy, exceedingly heavy. There had never been one like it before, nor would there ever be one again. And it covered the entire land, and the land became dark. And it ate up all of the vegetation and all of the fruits of the trees that were left over from the barad, and there was nothing left. There was no vegetable left on the tree or the grass throughout the entire land of Egypt. So it was devastating, absolute devastation. Then it says that Paro hastened, and the Mefarshim point out to prevent the next phase from happening. It took all of this to convince him that this was from Hashem. And then he hastened, but it wasn't fast enough to call to Moshe and Aaron, and he said, "Chatasi la Hashem alokeichem v'lachem. I've sinned against the Lord your God and you." Yeah, a lot of things are interesting over here. What does it mean that I've sinned against Hashem, your God, and you? Well, I guess he sinned against God because he didn't obey the command of God, and he sinned against you because I didn't let you serve your God. I didn't let you to have your religious fulfillment. Then he says, please bear my sin this time, but this time, or also this time, and entreat the Lord your God, and remove from me this evil, this death. Just this evil. But he doesn't say what he'll do. And Moshe doesn't ask him what he'll do. No commitments are made. It seems to be the first time that Paro said Chotasi. Actually, he said it before by Barad. Chotasi Hapam Hashem HaTzadik V'ani V'ami HaRashayim. He had said this before. It's not the first time that he said Chotasi. Then it says that Moshe entreated God, and God brought forth this powerful wind, and it carried forth the Arba, and put it in the Amsuf. There was not one left throughout the entire boundary of Egypt, and God hardened the heart of Paro, and he did not send Bnei Israel. The problem was that the reason why Chatasi, the sin was that who are you to challenge God? That's what God is commanding. He didn't accept the command of God. Did not. He was accepting it on his terms. In a manner, he was finding a way out of the problem. He didn't want to give in. But at the same time, he was afraid that he could not absolutely refuse. So what he tried to do is to work it out in a manner on his terms. That he wanted to do it on his terms. And in a way which made sense to him. He used an argument, but he was rationalizing it. And that to let God be with you and all of that. That's fine, but what are you taking the choice? Well, that was very, very nice, but it was not submitting to the will of God. And Moshe explained, he said, Chag, and that's the way we do it. But that's not because I want to do it that way, because that's the command of God. And you have to subordinate yourself to the command of God. That's why Paro was punished regardless. Because it doesn't matter that he gave in to part of it. And that because he was imposing his own conditions on it. Then he wasn't really giving in to the command of God. That's as far as he was prepared to go. So he deserved to be punished. He said, Chatasi. He did sin. Because it's meaningless to... That's what people do. They want to serve God according to their own terms, not according to God's terms. Different forms of Judaism today, too. They won't abandon the holidays completely, or they want to have something, but it's on their terms. It doesn't make sense to them. What Paro was saying is that this doesn't make sense to me. And the answer is, too bad. It doesn't make sense to you. It doesn't have to make sense. Who are you? Who are you? If you accept the whole mission of Moshe was to say that this is from Hashem, not from me. Like he said, that's what you atem. That's what you want. Atem of action. Kiosa atem of action. But it's not that we are seeking. We're just responding to the divine imperative. That's the whole thing. If that's the case, you can't ask questions. There's no room for negotiation. That's why the Makkah went ahead.